Last time we looked at the cantos of the sun, which is the canto of arithmetic, and so, and we discussed actually the variety of philosophical strains, theological and philosophical ideas that compose Dante's circle of knowledge, this encyclopedic compass of what's worth knowing. Today we move into the heaven of Mars, which is, as you know, the god of war, the name of the planet, and it's the heaven of music. Dante links Mars and music because harmony, out of the belief that harmony is the meeting point or the result of discordant elements, a kind of concordia, a concord, an attuning of hearts reached through discordant elements. The discordant elements can be different sounds, can be the passions within us that need tempering, and so on. This canto can be read profitably, and you can do some of this on your own, in conjunction, I will allude to it in passing, in conjunction with canto, for instance, 15 of Hell. We are in 15, 16, and 17 of Paradise. You could read it, 15 is the encounter with Dante's own ancestor, Cacciaguida. And so, inevitably, the reference to Brunetto Latini literally imposes itself on us. It compels us. We are compelled to draw parallels and see differences between the two ancestors who make different claims on this descendant, intellectual and dynastic descendant, who is Dante himself. You could also look at it from many other points of view. The point of view, for instance, of the other references to war and the kind of the clashing sounds throughout Inferno that Dante produces. If I were to give a title to my remarks today, which I really don't, because I think it's the variety of suggestions coming from a canto takes over. The desire to be too schematic and thematic. But if I were to give a title today, I think it's really very encompassing. I would call it Self and History. These seem to be the most, the strongest questions that Dante raises. They are not either terms, a question of self and history. The relationship between the two may be new to us here. But we certainly have been talking about history before. The last time we did was in the discussion of Canto 6 of Paradise, where Dante gives, in the heaven of Mercury, Dante gives this overall history of Rome, its humble beginnings, and then the construction of the empire and the crisis of the empire. So that's really one theme that you know. The issue of self in itself is something we've been discussing ever since we started with the Vita Nuova, with the idea of a lyrical self, of a self who removes himself, as you recall, that's what we mean by a lyrical self, removes oneself from the world of history, the contingencies of time, the viscous realities of the city, and takes shelter in the chamber of his imagination, in the world his ideas, his dreams, memories, and there he constructs his own self. That was the point of the Vita Nuova. When we began reading the Divine Comedy, I insisted on the autobiographical focus with which at least the Divine Comedy begins. This is his story, this is his unique experience, the pilgrim's own, Dante's own unique experience. And that seems to have come to an end with Purgatorio 30, when finally the novel of the self is sealed, as you remember, with the mentioning of the name Dante. Then a new phase begins in Dante's construction, which is more educational, more speculative, which is really the world of Paradise. But so we talk about self and history in a way that maybe Dante has never quite coupled the two terms before. He does so in Canto 15, 16, and 17 of Paradise. This is really the double focus around which everything moves. Let me give you, I will give you a reading of the various details, but let me give you an idea of what I have in mind, first of all, and the way of thinking about this issue. I want to draw your attention to the presence of some mythological figures that whom Dante is evoking. And they're very different among themselves, but they're all, it's a way of reflecting on Dante's own idea of selfhood, Dante's own relationship to an ancestor, his own private history, who in turn has had a very complex and for Dante ennobling relationship to history. He is a crusader. He fought in the Second Crusade of 1149 under the Emperor Conrad. He is proud of this belonging to the crusader, to fight as a crusader. So she's a version of the relationship one has or thinks one has with history, both Cacciaguida's and Dante's own relationship to his grandfather. But let me tell you, first of all, these mythic figures, and then we'll talk about them. Dante is beginning with Canto 15. I will just remark in passing, I will leave it to you to do more diligently than we could do it here, the presence of musical metaphors, which is not surprising in the heaven of the music, gracious will, into which, this is the beginning of Canto 15, rightly breathing love always resolves itself as the cupidity into an ill will, impose silence on that sweet lyre. This is the soul is becomes a kind of musical instrument, a sweet lyre, and still the sacred strings which the right hand of heaven tightens and relaxes, and so on. And then this and the gem at one point, this is line 20, and the gem did not leave its ribbon but ran across by the radio strip it seemed fire behind alabaster. With such affection did Anchises' shade reached out, if we may trust our greatest muse, when in Elysium he knew his son. And then in Latin, a quotation, O sanguis meus, O super infusa gratia Dei, sicut tibi cum bis unquam celi janua reclusa. To whom has this privilege ever been given of having the gates of heaven open to him twice? That's the delight spoke thus. So this is the first mythical reference. We are really, we could just say, well, Dante, of course, at the very beginning of Inferno, makes a reference to Paul and Aeneas, disavowing any strict connection with them. You remember when he resists the call to this huge, risky enterprise of going through hell that comes to him from Virgil. He says, I'm not Aeneas, I'm not Paul. Why should I do what you are calling me to perform? And Aeneas is the one who had visited Hades to meet the shade of his father, Anchises, now recalled here. And of course, Paul is the one who had been taken, rapt to the third heaven, meaning a third mode of vision that allowed him to and kept quiet about it, to see God face to face. But Anchises, the encounter between Anchises and Aeneas here stands for a sort of relationship of Aeneas that Aeneas has with history. Aeneas goes to Hades in order to find out what the purposes are for his journeying from Troy toward an unknown land. And he discovers it. So it's a way of Anchises discovers that he, from his own father, the presage, the prophetic, if you wish, announcement of what it is for him to be part of history. Somehow, a definition of self, that's what you find with Anchises, and the Aeneid can be understood as that. The sense that one, how does one belong in history, and one belongs in history as part of a providential pattern, as the idea that this was a destined empire that he, Anchises, had to found, and a new history would start, so that he confirms his attachment to the dead father, and yet he starts now as the point of beginning for a new history. This is one way of understanding an epic, the epic account, a myth of one's own self belonging in the world of history. This is mythical. We move on, and it's really a bit sort of a reversal of this. I will come back into Canto 16, Dante gives a chronicle of the city of Florence. That is to say, first of all, he's making problematical to us the idea of where are we to understand this as self. Yeah, it's not clear what we have to understand this as self. In the Vita Nuova, the self is this nexus of memories, fantasies, and the will to write poetry. And in that sense, the text constitutes oneself into a self. I am a self, I'm the author of this text. This becomes a point of reference. And this is what I am. The image and portrait that I give of myself gives you an idea of who I am. It doubles me, it perpetuates me, it's a poetic version of self. But we don't know yet what are we to take as a self. Anchises has a different understanding of himself. I am who I am only because I belong to a larger pattern of history. And this larger pattern of history is going to be me as a founder of a new way of looking at the world, the founder of Rome, and he gets the message from his own father. In Canto 16, and I will not go into this as I'm pursuing the theme of the mythic references, Dante goes on thinking about writing a chronicle, as I was saying, of the city of Florence. Florence is famous for its chroniclers that begin in the Middle Ages. So is history then the other problematical notion to be understood as the local events, or is it to be understood the way Anchises understands it, as a myth that somehow has a sort of paradigmatic value and which can regulate and also arrange. We can go on arranging our lives according to the demands of that myth. Dante would not answer this question directly here, but he does talk about all the Florentine families and talks about them in an elegiac manner. That is to say, they're all decayed. They're all finished and extinct. So whatever value this history may have, it's an elegiac commemoration of the past. Cacciaguida, by the way, is very elated at the idea that the son, the grandson, the descendant, wants to find out about the past. We move then into Canto 17, where I think we find something about this whole issue about history and the self. It begins in a peculiar manner. Look at the beginning of Canto 17. The reference is really, it's a long periphrastic. It's a circumlocutory periphrastic construction, a long turn of phrase for the pilgrim to describe himself in terms of Phaeton, the famous figure, as you know, from the classical myth, who challenges Apollo. We saw him in the corresponding canto 17 of Inferno. There was an allusion there to Phaeton, so a little touch of the symmetry of cantos, but that's really secondary at this point. Look at what the description is. Like him who came to Climene to be reassured about that which he had heard against himself. The disowning, first of all, it's a story that of the uncertainty of Phaeton's descendants that his father was Apollo. So he reassured himself. Him who still makes fathers weary with their sons. This isn't the canto of Cacciaguida. What is the real relationship? That's what Dante is asking that I have to this noble, heroic figure of whom I'm proud. But what is the actual relationship that joins me to them? Such was I, and such I was perceived to be both by Beatrice and by the holy lamp that had changed its place for me before. So he's happy that he seems to reaffirm this genealogical line. So history now becomes no longer a chronicle, becomes now a genealogy. Can we establish some certainties that we belong into a genealogical line? Can that really account for us and for who we are? So this is the issue that Dante is raising. The figure of Phaeton is a tragic figure because it introduces the possibility of, and Dante says that that's what makes fathers and weary of their sons all the time, the idea that the son wants to outdo the father, wants to go beyond the fathers, and that the idea of tragic transgression that can exist and therefore breach that line of continuity in the generations, across the generations. That's one of the myths. The other one is much more tragic than before. Canto 17, as you know, goes on discussing among other things, the, let me read the passage. I think that Dante says it much more sparingly, that is to say, without to my despair, says it much better than anybody else can. Contingency, this is line 36. Contingency, which does not extend beyond the volume of your material world, is all depicted in the eternal vision. You see, this is another way, still another way of understanding history, that there is a contingency, that the world of contingency can be subsumed within a larger transcendent paradigm. That seems to be the order of necessity. The contingent world is linked to the volume where all things are present, in the eternal vision, yet does not thence derive necessity any more than does a ship that drops. Is there some autonomy to contingency, or things determined by the order of necessity, downstream from the eyes in which it's mirrored. From thence, as sweet harmony, last time I mentioned it, musical language, musical lexicon abounds here, comes from an organ to the ear, comes to my sight the time that is in store for thee. I enjoy very much the implicit connection between time and music. Music becoming the metaphor that makes audible time itself. No? Time is constitutive of music, of course, but it really makes it. It's an acoustic translation of the silent arrow of time. And now this is the third mythological referent, Anchises. The tragic story of Anchises, who recognizes himself in the history and in the break, in the continuity with his father and in the break with Troy, from his father, from Troy, and the beginning of a new, let's say, history. Phaeton, who turns against his father and burns the heavens in doing so. That it's the famous metamorphosis of the origin of the Milky Way. As you know, the Milky Way was understood as the scorched heavens, a cosmological disaster that was happening on account of the rivalry between father and son. And now the third is As Hippolytus, the Phaedra, the story of the Phaedra. And I have to tell you this, as Hippolytus was driven from Athens on account of his cruel and perfidious stepmother, so must thou be driven from Florence. This is Cacciaguida, who announces the exile as the fatality that is hovering over Dante and for which he has to prepare himself. And exile, we see what it implies, also a sort of necessary detachment from one's family, one's country, one's all the possible lines that tend to join us and limit us too. So Dante's not quite Anchises. He's not out to establish an empire. He's not like the Phaeton. He does not want to overdo, at least literally, the father. And now let's see who is Hippolytus. As Hippolytus was driven from Athens on account of his cruel and perfidious stepmother, Phaedra, so must thou be driven from Florence. This is determined, nay, is already contrived. Look at the difference between determined and contrived, and the conjunction between the order of eternal destinies and the contrivance, the order of contingency, the maneuvers, infernal maneuvers against the pilgrim, and will soon be accomplished by him who meditates it in the place where Christ is bought and sold all day. The blame in the common cry shall follow the injured side, as always, but the vengeance shall be testimony to the truth that dispenses it. Thou, that's the announcement of the exile, thou shalt leave everything loved most dearly, and this is the shaft which the bow of exile shoots first. Thou shalt prove how salt is the taste of another man's bread, and how hard is the way up and down another man's salary, another man's stairs. Excuse me, here there is a terrible mistake that St. Clair makes, because Dante is very careful, line 60. He writes, Margaret, he writes, lo scendere e il salir per l'altrui scale, which means going down and up. And your translator, my translator here, has it the other way around, because he's following a logic which is all, we would call it naturalistic logic. You know, you go to the palace of the Duke, you go up, you climb the stairs, and then you come down after you have been begging for some charity, and then you have taken your morsel of bread and you can go down. But that's not what Dante says. He says you first go down and then you go up. And I hesitate to gloss it for you because I think it's a little bit clear that what kind of thing he means, that for him to go up was really a descent, was lowering himself. It's a little bit of, if you wish, it would seem to be a descent into pride, into humility, but at the same time, because he's reversing the natural order, the ordinary order of the action, it's really an ascent into pride. You know, for me to go up here is, it's like going down. I'm really degrading myself. So, but it's a very interesting line, acknowledgement of a sense of gratitude, a sense of the spiritual ascent being inevitably first a descent into the self and then becoming an ascent. So it's really, it turns the whole thing around. With up and down, another man stares, and that which shall weigh heaviest on thy shoulder is the wicked and senseless company with which thou shalt fall into that valley, which shall become wholly ungrateful, quite mad and furious against thee. So the story of Hippolytus is the story of the stepmother, to go back to this idea of self, it's the story of a stepmother who is trying to seduce Hippolytus. She's married to Theseus, and he runs away. So the family becoming the destructive, the form of the destructive desires within that family forces him to go away, run away, and dies. And so you wonder why Dante is taking on and thinking of this tragic figure to compare himself to. As he said, exile had this potentially destructive and tragic consequences that are happened to Hippolytus. At any rate, we have three great images by which Dante is thinking about what is the self, and how is the self to be determined? How does the self enter the world of history? What examples did he give? Can we talk about any of the examples in the past? I think that this is really the extraordinary, the burden actually of a text that I have been talking about in the past, and it's the Confessions of St. Augustine. That text is about the question of how the self is related to history. And Dante disagrees with Augustine. For Augustine, the self is one that takes refuge in the interiority of oneself and goes on then at the time, with the time of the conversion, he can now rejoin history, and that is to Dante clearly a way of entering history. The other motif that you can have is the motif of the other model that you have is the model of Cacciaguida, who goes on to a self-sacrifice of himself for the benefit of a larger cause, the cause of the Christian crusade in Jerusalem. Then there is the Aeneid that represents the idea of how the self enters the world of history. It's political activity, and Dante really sort of rejects all of them. This prophecy of exile, with which Canto 17 ends, gives an entirely different twist to the self's relationship to history. I will belong in history. There is no other way, Dante says, for the self to exist, if not by measuring oneself with the pressures of historical realities, but my own relationship to it is not that of belonging as Aeneas does into the world of history, with feeling that I am, that the political world is going to be my way out of this maze. It's not going to be the one like Phaeton, and it's not going to be the one represented by Hippolytus. It's the exilic self. An idea of a self is in utter dislocation from the world of history. But then, how are we to understand this dislocation? Is dislocation a way of actually removing oneself altogether? Or just saying that I'm out of place, just saying that I'm out of time, and somehow I have a relationship to history which is maybe polemical, maybe arguably constructive? And if so, what is the way? I think that we have to reread now the three cantos in some details, and we come up with an answer. You see then what this what the issues here are. Let me start with canto 15 and see what Dante is specifically doing above and beyond this this overall pattern that he's putting forth in the various cantos. You will see how in canto 15 let's go back to canto 15, and you will see that the relationship to Cacciaguida is also played etymologically, how often Dante is punning with the metaphor of wings. In Italian, it's ali, alighieri, aligher. That was the name, the bearers of wings. So the, for instance, line 52, I speak of thee, thanks to her who clad thee with wings for the lofty flight. Or a little later on line 70, I turned to Beatrice and she heard before I spoke and smiled to me, a sign that made the wings grow my will. And later, line 80, many, many times, he stops after the third time. For this reason that it's plain to you, are not equally feathered in their wings, etc. The first thing that they do though with the exchange, in the encounter with Cacciaguida, is focus on the city of Florence of old, an evocation of the golden age, a certain golden age, a kind of utopian construction. These are the lines. Florence, page two, lines, canto 15, lines 94, 97 and following. Florence within her ancient circle, from which she still takes tears and moans. These are the times of the day. Rung by the bells of the nearby church. Abode in peace, sober and chaste. She had no bracelet, no tiara, no embroidered gowns, no girdle that should be seen more than they were. Nor yet did the daughter at her birth put the father in fear, for age and dowry did not part from the due measure on the one side and the other. She had no houses empty of family, nor had Sardanapalus yet come there to show what could be done in the chamber. This is a kind of infernal, evocations. You know, these are, you are really thinking of Cleopatra in Canto 5. You are thinking of Semiramis, all those these figures of the chaos of the appetites, and they are being recalled now in this context. Nor yet did Uccellaccio and so on, and goes on talking about Cacciaguida's own birth, and then there. Let me focus a little bit on this the metaphors of of Florence, which you, first of all, Florence is evoked within a closed circle of self-sufficiency called within her ancient circle. The circle, the circularity of the city also implies a kind of plenitude and a sort of boundary. Dante does not have an idea of an expanding city. He enjoys and likes and projects this idea of a city held within its own perimeter, from which she still takes tears and moans. The language of space and the language of time follows, as if everything could be measured and everything could be interrelated. One is interrelated with the other. And then, this language of Florence as a woman, sober, chaste, abode in peace, sober and chaste, implying that here at least he believes, and it's lingering in him, the memory of the famous idea of the so-called body politic that you have heard, you know? The idea of the organic structure of the city as made of interdependent parts, just as space and time indicate the interdependent coordinates within which the life of the city can be recalled. And now, and then this is followed in turn by a sequence of anaphoras, all in the negatives. She had no bracelet, no tiara. This is a city, dressed like a woman. Dante, you know that one way of thinking about cosmetics is also to think of it, they used to think of cosmetics as bad rhetoric, perverse forms of seduction by means of which one could disfigure the natural continence and beauty of the human form. So Dante goes on in a sense by repeating these negatives, literally dispossessing, literally stripping the woman of all the superfluities, all this complications, and bring the city back to its own simplicity, its original chastity and simplicity. Let me just see this passage. She had no tiaras, no embroidered gowns, no girdle, nor yet did the daughter of her birth put the father in fear. It says she had no houses empty, etc. So this is the golden age. Does Dante really believe, though, in this myth of the golden age? Is it what we call, there is a rhetorical phrase for this sort of move, you know, the praising the bygone times. It's the so-called, it's a laudatio, that means a praise of the past, which is more of a rhetorical strategy to denounce the imperfections of today. In effect, Dante has a radically polemical view of the utopian spirit, this idea of a perfection that, or the claim of a perfection that we push back into the past because it's no longer with us, but we want to fantasize about. And nonetheless, he preserves it because utopia can become a kind of normative idea by means of which we can alter the configuration of our own contingencies, our own history. It may, utopias don't exist. They may even be dangerous, some people can claim. A lot of interesting figures in the history of ideas claim that utopias are dangerous constructions because they foment illusions about who we are, and yet they become for Dante necessary because we, in the light of those ideas, we can go on altering what we perceive as the degradations of our own times, and of course this myth of the golden age of Florence of the past literally disintegrates when seen in contrast with the reality of Dante's life as an exile, which is going to await him in the future. That is going to be, so it's exile as the realistic perspective of his being in history. And he makes a virtue of it. It's not a suffering, as we're going to see. Let me continue with my thought. He doesn't see that as a punishment. It induces suffering, but it becomes a virtue, and we shall see why it becomes a virtue, and in effect it will become a paradigm in which we can all recognize ourselves. In Canto 16, this myth of, because there's also this golden age of Florence with this allusion that it abode in peace, it lived in peace. Whenever I hear the language of peace, I do overhear the echo of Jerusalem, you know, the peace, the city of peace, right? And that what makes that interesting. So it's a typology of another city, the great time, the golden age of the past is a kind of what the prophets would always recall as the peace time of Jerusalem. That the Jews themselves had lost and kept on commemorating in the history. What makes this conjunction very strong is that, to me, is that in Canto 16, Dante goes on, first of all, talking about this, the chronicles. What is a chronicle? How does the chronicle change history? The chronicle reduces. It's a, it's a, it, there are it's a mode of historiography, a different mode of historiography. The place where you can find these modalities of history is really Boethius, who writes The Consolation of Philosophy, at the center of which he figures the Wheel of Fortune. Okay, you remember the Wheel of Fortune? There's this blindfolded woman who revolves, who rotates this wheel, and which means that we who are always on the shifty curve of the wheel will be up and down, right? So that a kind of historiography that derives from this Boethian insight is that of writing the lives of families that ascend and descend. And note the other mode of historiography, which would be the historiography of the fall of empires, for instance, what Augustine. So there are two historiographic models. The one that you're available in the City of God, where we are really told about the fall of the Persian Empire, the fall of the Roman Empire, you know, in a few pages, kind of Gibbons sort of, Gibbons does it in a much more detailed way, but this is really the idea. On the other hand, Dante goes to another historiographic model, which is that of chronicle. The idea that history is reducible to the events, the local events and circumstances of one's own life. He recalls all the families to the joy of the grandfather, who is, you know, you can understand the pleasure of memory. He shuttles back and forth between one item and the other, recalling everything. And Dante soon discovers that he does not quite belong, that kind of history does not really account for who he is and who he wants to be above all. And that somehow his definition of self will depend on a certain idea of the future and not of the past. I am trying to go back and to this idea of who the self is and what is history and how are we to understand history. But here, to continue with the notion of Jerusalem, which I bracketed a little bit and gave you a little digression on history, Dante goes on talking about a language. Turn to Canto 16, line 50, please, where he again talks about, it's all about Florence, all who were there at that time between Mars and the Baptist. The mythology of Florence. Cities, not only do you recount stories of families, you have to recount stories of the predominant, the sovereignty of mythologies that control our own self-understanding. We tend to understand ourselves in the light of presiding myths, of imaginative myths above us. So there's Mars, who was the god of Florence before the Baptist, John the Baptist, replaced him. So this is the account about the shifting mythology of the city. Mars and Baptist, able to bear arms, was a fifth of the number now living. Look, this is really an accounting, a chronicler's precision and accounting of Florentine local history. The number of now living, but the citizenship, which is now mixed with Ciampi and Certaldo and Figlina and so on, that language of mixture, which later becomes confusion. Dante will call it a confusion when he has to give a diagnosis at the top of page, line 67. Dante goes into a diagnosis of the crisis of the city, the mixture of peoples, where it was ever the beginning of the city's ills, as food in excess is of the bodies. Once again, the connection between, he's talking about the malaise of the city, but the connection between body and city. Cities grow and decay and get sick because of what he calls the confusion. First of all, he called the mixture. And confusio is the other name for Babylon. When you had to etymologize Babylon into the Romance languages and in English, it's confusion. So that the two myths of the city that Dante has in mind is Jerusalem for Florence and then Babylon for Florence of today. The two myths of the cities, of the two cities, are not antithetical. They are both possible within the same body politic. Okay, Florence can look like Jerusalem, or it can look like Babylon, according to the way the moral life of the city is lived out. So this is something that Dante will preserve, but it really implies that the city, the political world, is one which one has to shape all the time. That you cannot, there is no definite metaphor or emblem to define a particular city. A city can change its very identity. It can become like, can be like Jerusalem, as it was in the old, or it can be like Babylon now. The city involves us. We are involved in the city's history in the way of making it according to our own aspirations, our own ideas. We share in the shaping and construction of the city. This is no longer the perspective of the chronicler, it's the perspective of Dante the poet. So it's a critique of the inadequacy of the chronicler's view of what history could be. And now we go back to Canto 17, where once again, and I'm going to, I will not go, well, you remember it comes to Phaeton and the rivalry with the father. Dante's saying, if I don't belong to the city, and city and families go on decaying and disappearing, what is the true relationship that I have to this man who actually is directing me and unveiling for me that which the future, that which I have to expect from the future? So these are the kind of questions that he is very carefully raising. We go back to the famous description of the Dante's exile, where we did describe, yeah, thou shalt leave everything loved most dearly, lines 55, loved most dearly, and this is the shaft which the bow of exile shoot first. The condition, the harshness of exile could not be crystallized in sharpest terms. The severance, the separation of self from family as apparently as a punishment at this point. Thou shalt prove how salt is the taste of another man's bread. There are those who think that here Dante is finding a little bit of mildly comical relief in remembering the fact that in Florence they do not use salt in their bread, but anywhere else around this. Here we have a frequent flyer to Italy who knows very well this little history. But I don't think that it's all that comical. I think it's the bread. It's the most sacramental of foods, right? That he's talking about. And then we shall see how he picks up the idea of the bread in a moment. It's just not a metaphor there. Thou shalt, and how hard is the way down and up another man's stairs. And that which shall weigh heaviest on thy shoulder is the wicked and senseless company. The word picks up the metaphor of the bread, because company means, and that which simply means, the sharing of bread with others. So bread truly sacramental in the sense that it joins and brings about the unity of the body, of the body politic. What Dante is saying is that it's a reflection on his own life, a literal reflection on his own life. He went into exile, as you know, in the year 1302. And for a number of years, he went on, at least 2-3 years, plotting along the side of his other fellow exiles, the return to Florence and the destruction of the enemies who had banished them. Really, the plot of revenge in order to restore what they saw as justice. Dante very quickly understood that this was the way to absolute destruction. So he just from then on moves like a shabby derelict. You know, he represents himself limping at the beginning of Inferno, and that is really the way we are asked by him to imagine him as he goes. When he's talking about exile, we are not talking about living in some kind of isolated splendor in some court or other. It literally means going from place to place, begging. So this is punishment for him. And yet, let's see what happens. With which thou shalt fall into that valley, which shall become holy and grateful, quite mad and furious against thee. He is an exile to the exiles. Both the Guelphs and Ghibellines distrust him and take their distance from him. But before long, they, not thou, shall have their brows red for this. Of their brutish folly, their doing shall give proof, so it shall be to thine honor to have made a party by thyself. What an extraordinary line. To be absolutely on your own, a party to thyself. This should make you, should give you some perplexity, to say the least. Because you may remember that the Divine Comedy begins with the representation of the so-called neutral angels. And those neutral angels were angels who wanted to be neither with God nor against God, but they want to be by themselves. You remember how I pointed that out to you, that for Dante this was the most despicable of conditions and choices, though it seems to be non-choice. One is really choosing anyway, even when we are not choosing, we are choosing, and he was separating that. To him it's despicable not to take sides, to sit on the fence. And now he seems to attribute that very condition to himself. That to you, it will be to your honor to be a part to thyself. And no, we did not read it, but you know, with those of you who are so taken with the poem, you can go and read Canto 8 of Paradise, where Dante will ask one question he to the soul that he meets. He says, is it right for a man in the city to be a citizen? Yes, he says. And I don't even want to ask why. It's so clear. It needs no justification, no explanation. You have to be part of the belong to the world where you are. And yet now he takes the other side. He has to be by himself. What does it mean to be by himself? Is that a kind of neutrality he's imagining? It's really the condition of exile, I think, that he's really describing the destitution, the loneliness, the severance of the self from others. But even that can become a condition that triggers a new form of relationship. The exile is still part of the community. And let's see how he is thinking of this. I don't want to. This is now the specific prophecy of what's in store for the exile. And I think it retrieves, that's this, in this sense I mean that Dante is bringing about a transformation of the idea of exile from what seemed to be a punishment into a virtue. There is such a thing as a virtue of exile. The language with which Dante presents the world to come for him, the future, this is his future, it's not the past. History then is understood as, above all, futurity. We are here oriented to the future. The only real time that we have, we don't have it yet, but we can, it's the time of one's projects. It's the time in which one can really define oneself. I'm not really my past, so I have some contact with the past, my memories, and my memories can tell you me where I'm going, but then a catastrophe occurs. The need to sever yourself from anything that you know most and you love most dearly, family, city, loyalties, your habits, your bread, all of these details are here are given. And this is what he finds, their first refuge, an inn. The inn, as of those of you who read, it's an interesting metaphor in medieval literature, those of you who read Chaucer, is anybody here who reads Chaucer? The Canterbury Tales, of course, that it's the story of pilgrims, and the inn becomes the station, the temporary dwelling of people who are on the road and always moving. It's really one of the most welcome images in the medieval imagination, the inn, the provisional comforts for the night that the inn offers. And anyway, the first refuge, an inn that shall find in the courtesy of the great Lombard. This is the gentleman of Verona, the one gentleman of Verona who houses him and hosted him for a while, who bears on the ladder the sacred bird, and he will hold thee in so gracious regard that of doing and asking between you two, that shall be first, which the others come after. With him thou shalt see one where his birth so took the impress of this mighty star that his deeds will be renowned, that people have not yet taken note of him because of his youth, for these wheels have circled about him only 9 years. But before the Gascon deceives the noble Henry, sparks of this heroism shall appear in his disregard with both of wealth and toil, and his munificence shall yet be known so that his enemies cannot keep silent about it. Look to him and to this his benefits. Through him there shall be altered fortune for many, rich changing state with beggars, and thou shalt bear this written in thy mind about him, and shall not tell it. And he told things which shall be incredible to those that witness them. Then he added, Son, these are the glosses on what I was told thee in Inferno 15, of course, remember, where Brunetto says, this is the prophecy of your future exile, but it will be glossed for you by somebody else. He doesn't even mention it. Dante goes on thinking that it's going to be Beatrice. It turns out to be his father, his ancestor. These are the snares that are hid behind a few revolving years. Yet I would not have thee envious of thy fellow citizens, for thy life shall far outlast the punishment of the perfidies. The exile can turn into a virtue, and the language here that accompanies this prediction is the language of the ethics of exile, that the exile brings about and needs in order to be bearable and tolerable, the hospitality. These are the courtesy, the hospitality, the language of gratitude, the giving. So it's a new ethics is going to be described from the perspective of this exilic experience of Dante. And then Dante concludes, which I think it seals what I have been saying. And I see well, my father, this is line 113 and following, 110 and following. I see well, my father, how time spurs towards me to deal me such a blow as falls most heavily on him that is most heedless. It is well, therefore, that I am me with foresight. That's another virtue of exile. The word translates, prudence. Prudence is the human counterpart of providence. It has the same etymology. A seeing in advance, trying to not predict but forestall the arrows and flings that come our way, so that if the dearest place is taken from me, I may not lose to others the others by my songs. Down through the world of endless bitterness, and on the mountain from whose fair summit the eyes of my lady lifted me, and after through the heavens from light to light, I have learned that which, if I tell again, will taste for many of bitter herbs. And if I am a timid friend to truth, I fear to lose my life among those who will call these times ancient. The light within which was smiling the treasure, and another reference to Brunetto, who wrote The Treasure, of course, I had found there, first became a blaze like a golden mirror in the sun that replied, conscience dark with its own or another's shame would indeed feel thy words to be harsh. But nonetheless, put away every falsehood and make plain all their vision, and then let them scratch where is the itch. For if thy voice is grievous at first taste, it will afterwards leave vital nourishment when it is digested. This cry of thine shall do as does the wind, which strikes most on the highest summits. And that is no small ground of honor. For that reason have been shown to thee in these wheels on the mountain and in the woeful valley only souls that are known to fame, because the mind of one who hears will not pause or fix its faith for an example that has its root unknown or hidden, or for other proof that is not manifest. What he hears, and the decision that Dante will take as a palliative, at least, or a remedy to his exile, is writing. The writing of the poem becomes the act by which he, as an exilic, as an exile, can go on, and in his dislocation, his utter dislocation from the city, from family, from his habits, can go on actually relating himself to the world. Writing, the work, is the way in which the self enters history and can shape history. It's not Aeneas, it's not Phaeton, it's not going to be the Hippolytus, it's not even Cacciaguida's own account of his own grandiloquent connection with the world of history. The way in which this Dante self enters history is through this idea of poetry, of a writing that is now also described in terms of food, as you can see here. First of all, with the bitter herbs, and now the voices give us a first taste. It will afterwards leave vital nourishment when it is digested, etc. Words, first of all, let me just clear the air here. No one of you has these misconceptions about poetic language, that somehow it's some sort of faint symbol divorced from reality. Dante goes beyond this idea of the relationship of language to representation. That was the problem of the chronicles. And they gave fairly faithful accounts, and he can give fairly faithful accounts. That's the mode of a certain historiography. What Dante is saying is that words are things in themselves, that words are food that change, and being things, they have a kind of solidity and have a sort of truth value in and of themselves. This is really the biblical language that resurfaces. You know, son of man, eat the book. You remember these lines from, say, Ezekiel? This is exactly the kind of language that is returning here, and which Dante bends, this sort of language, to define himself in relationship to his future project of writing the poem, and that project of writing the poem is his way of establishing his place literally in, which is a utopian place, in history. I say utopian because it doesn't have to be understood in any local sense. You know, so I do not belong to the city only because I occupy a particular place in the city. It is the act of writing poetry. That's really what matters. What I'm referring to is also a sort of correction, very mild correction, of the classical idea, which is also medieval, survives in medieval times, the idea that the self is decided, the value of the self is decided by the place one occupies within the economy of the city. Dante says that's not the way it works. I am the project of writing my poetry, and through poetry, which is written in exile, and therefore it's a poetry of exile, I can re-enter the world of history. The world of history, accusing history and talking as a man who has been touched by the vision of what justice ought to be. So this is really the remarks that I think I can make about these cantos, 15, 16, and 17, and I welcome questions. If you have any, I'm sure you do. Yes.
Would I be right in seeing some biblical references within the lines between 70 and 100? Mention of the star, the birth, the inn.
Line 17. The question is, would you be right in seeing biblical antecedents, context, for the lines that go from line 70, you say, the first refuge, and in, shall find in the courtesy of the great Lombard, there may be a Christological or a Christomimetic language behind this sort of references. And that would be even more, it would be truer even, would be more made more compelling in light of Cacciaguida's own self-representation in Christological terms, both in Canto 15 and in Canto 16. Actually, he talks of himself as if he were a Boethian philosopher. Dante uses the same phrase about the death of Cacciaguida that he had used for Boethius in Paradiso e venni dal martirio a questa pace, that he had used for Boethius. But the language is a Christological language. The only difference is that if there is any Christological resonance here, it very quickly fades, because Dante is really discussing himself as an exile with this, and he understands exile as the real condition of human of himself, but also of human beings. I will go on so far as to say, in order to connect your theological perspective and what I have been saying about the self in history, is that exile is also the root of one's religious consciousness. We have those of us who have a religious consciousness, I think we all do, just as we have an aesthetic sense, we all do, that religious consciousness comes always out of the sense, or the feeling, even better than the sense, the feeling that we are not where we should be, that we somehow are not where we should be, both in terms of time and or in terms of space, that we are dislocated. And this exile, this exilic imagination, then shapes also the theological language of Dante, and accounts for his persuasion that exile defines the human condition, and it's not just an empirical, it is his empirical experience. It relates to him, but he understands that it's really, we are all engaged in this kind of, I'll talk about this later, by the way. I'm forcing my hand because the text does not really allow me to do that, but when he discusses hope, the most extraordinary of all virtues, the most deceptive maybe of all virtues, there he links hope and exile in a very clear way, and I reserve that as a surprise for whatever, next week or maybe, yeah, next week. Please.
Yeah, you mentioned Augustine's Confessions earlier and talking about the different conceptions of how the self relates to the city, and you said Dante doesn't agree with Augustine. I didn't catch everything that you were saying about Augustine's view of the self in relation to history. Would you just read?
The question is about, I was discussing modalities of this relationship between the self and history at the beginning of my remarks, and one of them obviously was, I mentioned, let me just give a little resume of this, mentioned the Cacciaguida himself, who has a kind of special understanding of history, and that defines him, his taking part in the Crusades. The other one is, with which Dante begins, is Aeneas, who is a model for Augustine, as you know. So I'm answering your question now. The Confessions of Augustine are constructed as nothing less than what I call the Aeneid of the heart. That is to say, here he goes from Carthage, he has his Didos, you remember when he leaves Carthage to go to Rome, and the Dido, he doesn't just abandon them, but he describes them as they hold on to his garment, etc. Then he goes to Rome. So it's really a pattern on an epic, on the Virgilian epic of the Aeneid. But Augustine is very different from Aeneas. He doesn't go to Rome to found an empire. He's a professor of rhetoric. He teaches, he's a teacher, a professor of rhetoric, and he comes to understand himself. Actually, the great moment, the great revelation for him, there are two moments of great revelation to him, which we never talked about. The one which he has while he's in Ostia, that little town by the sea outside of Rome, and he sees this mother at the window, and they share in a kind of mystical vision. He describes this ecstasy that they have while they look outside, and then she's about to die. She will die. But that is a decisive moment clearly in his life and his understanding of himself. And the other one comes in the garden in Milan when he hears voices that tell him that he understands in his own way. So it's an idea of a self which is which understands the self as a death of the old man and the birth of a new man. This is the old Adam and the new Adam, the Christian idea of conversion. St. Paul's command: you have to let the old man die so that the new man can come into being. That's the understanding of the self. Now, Dante, of course, when I say he doesn't agree with, of course, he's not Aeneas. He did say that. He's not Paul. He did say that. There are those who say, well, he's ironic. I don't see where the irony is. He's not Aeneas. He's not Paul. he uses them to relate, to coordinate himself to them. And now he's using a number of other mythical figures. What is one's own relationship to genealogy? What is one's own relationship to the chronicles? What is his own relationship to mythical empires? You understand what I'm saying? The idea of self that he's going to have is not really Augustine's. It's that of the man, first of all, who can belong to the history of the world by writing the poem. And he lives and he understands the fundamental quality of the exilic experience of human beings. That's not Augustine. So that's really what I meant. No disrespect for Augustine, only a different experience. Yes?
I'm still thinking about the brief reference to the Crusades that Cacciaguida makes at the end of the 15th canto and the presence of sectarian violence. And I wonder if Dante has some idea about that connects to his idea of the empire as staving off the political violence of civil war, or what would Dante suggest as a solution? Because we saw St. Francis last week who spoke peacefully with the Sultan of Faith.
This is an extraordinary question. And the question is, by the way, how do I explain Cacciaguida's reference to the Crusade, very brief reference to the Crusade, and how does that connect with what we have been talking about, sectarian violence in the Canto of Dominic, for instance, in Canto 12, and whether Dante is using this as a ploy to explain, just the way he does with the violence within the city to justify the necessity of the empire, which he does, or is this... does he really have an idea of the peaceful language of Francis? Accurate? You asked a lot of questions, and they're really, 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 really impressive. After all, she's an Italian major. What do you expect? She better impress me, you know? You did. We'll talk more about Dante's preparing Canto 18, 19 and 20. Is really about, it starts with what is a heroic life and how are we to understand the heroic life. So, and there is a reference there also to Crusades and the question of the Crusades, the relationship of justice and Christian ideas of justice to Muslims and Hindus will come to the forefront there. So I really ask you to wait for that for next time, because however I can answer one question immediately, which is really implied by what you are saying, more than asked directly. Yes, Dante is a peace poet. I would say that with full confidence, though we know Dante is so polemical, kicks shades, is angry, fights, and has always competing visions in relation to the tradition and others. But he's fundamentally, you have to establish, you would say, differences, not really renounce your differences, but actually make of differences the orchestration, the musical orchestration that is going on in cantos 15, 16, and 17. This is the heaven of music. These discordant discourses are part of a sovereign and transcendent order. But he's a peace poet, which is truly scandalous, because most poets, except for Isaiah, for instance, who is a peace poet, okay, prophet, but he's a prophet of peace, with a vision of peace. Dante really has an Irenic vision. Most poets write about victories, about wars, about armistices or truces, the epics in England or in Italy, it's all about the clashes of armies, etc. Not Dante. So that's really the direct answer I can give to your question. But then you raise another issue, which I find a little bit, I would not want to go there, but I owe it to you to give an answer. You say, well, what about the peaceful language of Francis? And that seems to be such a great idea, because heresy and schisms in the question, the relationship between Christians and Muslims has always been one of wars. So heresy and war, schism and war, So we can say that Dante seems to be so radical in renouncing war and says, look, it's possible to harmonize relationship, or at least confront her differences in with using a peace language. Okay, that's... However, things are not as simple as that. And that's why I only mention it, but I will not go into that. We haven't got time for that. It's really a thought I'm a little developing, I must admit. The heresy is a question of language. It's not just a question of wars. So there are wars that go on in language. And therefore, they re-propose the very differences and stubborn divisions of understanding that qualify and describe both the schisms and the heresies. So to say peaceful language, it sounds also like another way of, another route into potential dissent and tragedy, as you see. But I'm not going to go any more than give you as a kind of suspicion that I have about my own claim that Dante is a peace poet. We'll talk though about the Crusades next time, and maybe I have time for another question, maybe, and a very short answer. Anybody? See you next time.